Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,800 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Adrian Wolfson, author of On the Future of Species, Authoring Life by Means of Artificial Biological Intelligence. Imagine a future where we grow houses rather than build them, where smartphones are living, clothing has opinions, and all human knowledge fits into a speck of DNA. A world where disease is a thing of the past and the human lifespan is dramatically extended. In On the Future of Species, Adrian describes how we are at the cusp of a technological revolution driven by the convergence of artificial intelligence and synthetic biology. Currently at the scribbling phase, writing the genomes of viruses, bacteria, and yeast, we will eventually author the genomes of extinct and never before realized species. Adrian Wolfson is the co-founder of Genero, a California-based biotechnology company specializing in synthetic genome design and construction. He is the author of the critically acclaimed Life Without Genes, The History and Future of Genomes, and An Intelligent Person's Guide to Genetics. He has authored more than 160 scientific papers, book chapters, reviews, and patents, and is a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal and Science Magazine. For more information, you can visit his website, which is adrianwolfson.com, and that's Adrian, W-O-O-L-F-S-O-N.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Adrian to the show. Good day, sir.
Good day, Robert. Such a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. This topic is fascinating. You know, it's hard to believe that some of these things are in our future, possibly near future. So let's start with what sparked your interest in genetics?
Wow, that's a very interesting question. I think, you know, from a young age, Robert, I was fascinated by the human body as a kind of machine, if you like, right? How did it operate? You know, why do we get ill? Why do we age? You know, why is it that if you pull off the leg of a newt, it can regrow it, but we can't, you know? So I think my curiosity was very much rooted in, understanding all of these different aspects of human nature, if you like, right? And as I grew older, I began to realize that, you know, genetics was really key to understanding how we get to be the way we are, and also, you know, why we get ill, why we age, all of those things, right? So it's the kind of starting point. It's not everything, because obviously there are other things like environment and development and learning and culture and microorganisms and all of those things, right? But I think that genetics forms the kind of foundation upon which all living things and indeed humans are built.
Yeah, that is, I think, a curiosity of many young people, you know, recognizing the limits and the impact of genetics. And you are right, there are many variables that contribute to our life experience. In the topic, it talks about synthetic biology. Can you tell us a little bit about what synthetic biology is?
Yes, I can. So historically, all of nature, all of biology has been built by the process of, we believe, evolution by natural selection over a timeline of about 4 billion years. So you could call nature, if you like, natural biology, right? It's a kind of mindless process. When I say mindless, I mean that, you know, generally one can agree that, you know, one can still believe in a creator. You know, I don't think anything about evolution in any way negates religious beliefs about creation of the universe and all those things, right? But the actual process by which living things originated appears to be explained quite efficiently by natural selection. And natural selection doesn't have any purpose, you know, it doesn't have any end game, if you like. So the fact that humans evolved was not inevitable, right? We might, you know, if you were to replay the tape of life, you may never see humans again, right? So, but that's natural biology, right? So artificial biology, or what you could call synthetic biology, right, is when we begin to understand the rules which are used to generate living things, right? Because, you know, if you build a tulip or a pelican or an ant or a human or a watermelon or a tomato, you know, clearly there's some kind of generative logic that enables biology to build those structures, right? In the same way that when you build the Freedom Tower or the Sydney Opera House or Big Ben in England, right? You know, the architects had a kind of plan which they then executed according to certain rules and logic, and they constructed it, right? So nature must also have its own kind of equivalent of that, right? And if we were able to understand how those biological plans work, right? You know, how the grammar of life turns raw materials into a tomato rather than a lettuce, or an ant into an ant rather than a kangaroo, right? If we can understand those rules, that grammar, then all of a sudden we can actually use those rules to build synthetic species or to alter natural species in ways that are beneficial to us, right? So that's what I mean by the term, or what is meant by the term synthetic biology. It's biology which is artificial in the sense that it's humans, you know, using AI or not, who can actually manipulate biology. Now, of course, there is a kind of higher order philosophical argument on top of that, which is that if it's humans that are doing this, is it actually unnatural? You know, because we are part of nature. So you could argue anything we do is natural, right? And not synthetic or artificial. But I think actually one can realistically make that distinction, you know, because, you know, it's quite clear that natural phenomena kind of emerge in an organic manner over very long periods of time, and they kind of co-evolve. And so there's a kind of natural harmony, if you like, between them, mm-hmm. Which isn't necessarily the case for synthetic biology.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that distinction. Now, is there a current state of synthetic genome design?
Yeah. I mean, the current state is that we're at the kind of, you know, kids level version of writing. So I divide the history of life into three phases. You know, one is where we just observe life, right? And we name life and we catalog life, right? Which is most of human history, right? Like we give names to species, and then more recently we actually learn how to sequence the genomes of living things, right? That's all just cataloging and observing, right? The second phase is when we learn to edit life, right? With CRISPR, the gene editing technology. But when you edit life, you're basically kind of like redlining it. You know, when you have a piece of like a document on your computer, a Word document, and you redline it, right, when you edit it. Well, that's what gene editing is. It's not creating anything new. It's just fiddling around with something that exists. But we're now in a third phase of life where we're literally taking a blank piece of paper and we're authoring life like writers, right? Writers don't, I mean, they're influenced by pre-existing work, right? Mark Twain, I'm sure, was influenced by many writers that came before him. But when Mark Twain, you know, wrote Huckleberry Finn, you know, that just came straight out of his mind, right? You know, he didn't start off with some kind of version of Mark Twain that he edited. He just wrote it on a blank piece of paper. So in order to do that, you need to understand the grammatical rules of life. We don't really understand them very well right now, but what we can do, we can't write the equivalent of, you know, a novel, if you like, or War and Peace or any other complex novel or work, you know, written work. But what we can do is produce very rudimentary scribblings, if you like, or like kid story equivalents of synthetic biology, because we know the very basics of the rules of life. And so the equivalent of that is writing the genome of a virus, because a virus actually isn't even a living thing. It has a genome, but it needs to infect a bacterium to become alive, right? And we can, as of today, not only build viruses, but we can design them using AI. So that's the kind of state of the art of synthetic biology. So it's the equivalent of being able to write the most rudimentary, not even Dr. Seuss level kid story, something, not even a comic, you know, it's something way, way simpler. It's like your kid kind of learning to string the first sentences together. The cat sat on the mat and the sun rose over the hill and the big man lived in the small house kind of level, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if we want to graduate from that to being able to write more sophisticated stories and then eventually whole novels, we're going to need to kind of understand the grammar of life far better than we do today, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the way we do that, we use AI to look at biology and huge databases of biological phenomena and kind of pull out the rules of biology in much the same way that ChatGPT, when it was trained, looked at huge amounts of human text, whether it was emails or advertisements or discussions on Facebook or whole novels or whatever it was. AI had to be trained, right? Mm-hmm. And then by training AI, it was able to learn the English grammar, and then eventually it was able to write, you know, things for us, right? And we're I'm continuously amazed by how well it does that, right? So eventually we'll be able to create the kind of ChatGPT equivalent for biology, and the ChatGPT equivalent of biology will not be writing stories, it will be writing genomes. So you may say, hey, write me the genome of a bacteria that can eat up microplastics in the ocean. And the ChatGPT will just spit out that sequence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you will be able to go and build it and build that bacterium. Or you might say, hey, write me the genome of a type of maize that has 10 times the efficiency of, you know, of yield, let's say, right? Or that's immune to all of the pests that destroy maize, or that can grow in the Sahara Desert. And it will either say, yeah, here they are, or no, there is no such genome, right? Or you may say, hey, ChatGPT, rewrite the genome of chromosome whatever to get rid of diabetes, right? And it will say, sure, you know, here's a way of doing it. However, if you do that, you're going to cause these other issues, or maybe not, right? So that's what I mean by making biology kind of fully understandable, fully computable, and understanding the grammar of life. It's getting that kind of real fluency and understanding of how nature does it, and then copying it, basically, and maybe even going beyond it.
Yeah. So what would you say are the challenges right now with genome design?
Well, the challenges are that in order to go beyond designing viruses and bacteria, because I think we're kind of pretty much close to the point where we'll be able to design new species of bacteria, but to go beyond those very simple organisms and simple grammatical rules to more complex organisms, even say a yeast, which is a eukaryotic organism. It's more like its cells are like our own. They have a nucleus and they have a more complex structure. To do that, we're going to have to work out how to train these kind of genomic chatbots, if you like, right? And to do that, we're going to have to know what to train them on, and we're going to most likely have to generate those databases ourselves very specifically and deliberately so that they can kind of progress to the next level of understanding, right? So I think identifying what those databases should be and then constructing them and then training the AIs and changing their architectures accordingly, because the AIs have to have specific architectures to be able to learn this grammar, and I can explain that better, if you like, in a minute. I think that's the initial challenge, and let me just go back to that point about the architectures, right? So the thing about DNA is that if you write a sentence, you know, yesterday I walked to the shop and then I purchased a new suit, right? Mm-hmm. In those two sentences, you pretty much have all the information you need to comprehend them, right? You know, it's kind of self-contained, right? So what that means is if you were then to write another 100 paragraphs, it's most unlikely that those 100 paragraphs would have any impact on those two sentences. They're kind of standalone. That's not the case in DNA. In DNA, sentences, if you like, DNA sentences that are located at great distances from individual sentences can actually change their meaning, right?
Hmm.
What that means functionally is that the AI that you use to decipher that meaning has to be able to look at big chunks of DNA all in one go and look for relationships that can be quite distant from one another. So a chemical letter in the DNA sequence, a million letters away from another letter, can exert this kind of action at a distance effect, right? So your AI architecture has to accommodate that. Now, for example, in the chatbot, genomic chatbot that was used to write the first ever AI designed virus, that was actually my colleague at Stanford called Brian He, and he developed the, you know, this kind of genomic chatbot called Evo2. And to develop Evo2, he had to use an architecture called Striped Hyena, which enabled the AI to look at these action at a distance effects, like, you know, looking at relationships between DNA chemicals that were a million nucleotides apart, right? You have to be able to do that. And as time goes on, I think we're going to find that that so-called context window needs to be even bigger. So you need to be able to look at individual DNA chemicals, but also at these hugely distant effects. And funnily enough, in the quantum world, there's a name for this. It's kind of an entanglement, right? So in quantum entanglement, if you do something to an atom in France, you can feel the effect in New York, right, at this huge distance. So we don't really understand quantum entanglement very well. But genomes are kind of entangled, right, in that way. You have all of these action and distance effects. So that's, to me, the key challenge.
Yeah, boy, that's fascinating. Yeah, the idea of entanglement is, to me, it's just very interesting because it seems to go beyond our understanding of physics in how things relate to each other or impact each other at a distance. So, and it seems that that particular aspect would be, it would be just very challenging to be able to wrap one's self around, you know, the fact of first identifying the impact what one would have on another, and then also being able to minimize the negative impact that would be.
I mean, You know, entanglement can either be seen as a real phenomenon, and by that I was using it more as a metaphor for action at a distance effect, but there may also actually be real quantum entanglement, right? And that's something we will have to consider because, you know, quantum phenomena are real, and we know that they can extend beyond the atomic scale, but as of today, we don't really, you know, have any proper understanding of quantum phenomena in biology, right? But they almost certainly do exist. But for the moment, I think we just focus on the kind of metaphorical use of entanglement, which is these kind of action at a distance effects of how a little bit of DNA over here can have an effect on a little bit of DNA way over there, you know? Right. And we need to be able to kind of link together those effects, the causality, and that's why the next generation of AI that we use to decipher the rules of biology will have to kind of be able to incorporate greater and greater action at a distance effects.
Yeah, wow. Now, the company which you co-founded, Genero, was just announced that they have an exclusive license from Caltech for Sidewinder, a novel DNA construction technology. So tell us a little bit about Sidewinder.
Yeah, basically, if you want to practice the art of synthetic biology, you know, you need two key skills. One is you need to be able to design DNA. And we've talked about that a little bit. You know, that's the AI chatbot language of DNA side of things, right? But once you've designed the DNA using AI, you actually need to physically build it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Sidewinder comes in. Now, Sidewinder was developed at Caltech by one of my other co-founders. So Brian He at Stanford at the Arc Institute, one of my co-founders, developed Evo 2, which is that chatbot, you know, genome design AI. But the other side of it, the actual physical construction, if you like a kind of laser printer for DNA, was built at Caltech by my other co-founder, Kaihang Wang, in collaboration with Noah Robinson, his brilliant then PhD, now postdoctoral student, who's now the CTO of Genero. And they developed a method for building DNA at scale of any sequence complexity incredibly rapidly, accurately, of any size and at low cost, right? So this is really quite revolutionary and very disruptive to this field because all of a sudden you can match what you can do in design with physical construction. You know, it's all very well to be able to produce incredible architectural plans for cathedrals and skyscrapers, but if you can't actually build them, they have no value, right? But all of a sudden now with Sidewinder, it gives us the ability to contemplate building these designs, DNA designs at scale in a way that can be done, you know, quickly, accurately, but importantly at considerably lower cost than we've been able to do in the past because cost does become prohibitive at a certain point.
Yeah. Now, with any technology, there's always some opportunities for, you know, proper, useful applications, but also sometimes there's idea of misuse can come in. So what are some of the, I guess, activities that we need to be aware of or be aware of?
Yeah, well, you know, technology itself obviously is morally neutral, right? So,
correct.
You know, we cannot and should not stop our imaginations from wandering into new places because that's what makes us human at the end of the day, right? It's the ability to be able to imagine the world being different, imagining the human condition being enhanced in some way, you know, like just easier to live, right? Like that we don't have to worry about food, we don't have to worry about water, we have, you know, shelter, we have all the things that we need to live a good life. We don't need to worry about illness, we can be happy, we can, you know, spend enough time in leisure, you know. Those are all the things that make human life, you know, decent and being free and all those things, right? But some of the things that we develop, some of the inventions to enable us to do that, paradoxically can also be very harmful. And some examples of that are fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
fire can keep us warm and it can cook our breakfast and it can be used to melt, you know, metals to build, you mm-hmm. know, things out of iron or gold or whatever. But it can also burn down cities and be very destructive, right? The wheel is a very dangerous technology. It can be used to build tanks and war chariots, but it can also allow you to go on your trans-American summer tour, right? So the technology itself is morally neutral. And when it comes to nuclear technology, you know, you can use nuclear technology for the production of clean energy or to build an atomic weapon, right? So
mm-hmm.
we just have to accept that biology is no different. The main difference, however, is that biology is a technology that's far more available than, say, nuclear energy, because, you know, nuclear technology is in the hands of very few people, so it's easier to safeguard it and to regulate it. Biology mm-hmm. is being democratized, you know, increasingly on a daily basis, and it's going to be in the hands of many, many people, which makes it much harder to control and therefore more dangerous. So yes, there are downsides, and the downsides can be divided into things that people do by mistake, inadvertently create genomes of organisms that can destroy the environment or be harmful to humans. And so, you know, inadvertently or deliberately, you know, there are mm-hmm. bad actors out there, whether they're nation states or individuals, who will, you know, not think twice at building organisms that can cause a lot of harm, right? So we have to be really careful how we regulate and govern this technology and do everything we can to ensure that we use it safely, wisely, ethically, equitably, responsibly, and in a way that benefits society and doesn't harm nature, you know, because
yeah.
we need to make sure that we keep nature intact and preserve it. And, you know, and actually this technology can do that because if we start to move towards a world in which biology becomes infrastructure so that we start to build materials out of biology, which is obviously fully sustainable, and create bioenergy and store information in DNA and create crops which produce greater yields and so on and so forth, then we won't have to destroy the world in the way that we currently are. You know, if
mm-hmm.
food production efficiency increases tenfold, we won't need to mow down the last Amazonian rainforest and destroy all those species and destroy wilderness in Asia and Africa, you know, we'll be able to preserve yeah. them. And those species are part of the precious heritage of humanity, right? And we have a moral responsibility as the custodians, the short-term custodians, because we'll all be dead in, you know, 100 years, within 100
mm-hmm.
years or sooner. And, you know, we have to think about our children and our children's children and their children, all future humanity, and the legacy that we leave. We cannot be seen as the generations that destroyed nature for everybody else. What kind of legacy is that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, we have to be moral and responsible custodians of the earth. And
yeah.
even for those people who deny climate change, of which I am not one, but even for those people who cannot bring themselves to accept that we are harming the climate, even those people have to acknowledge that we're polluting the world, filling it with microplastics and destroying nature. You know, no, I don't think anybody with a hand on their heart could possibly defend that. You know, I'd love to see anybody try and defend that. publicly, right, and really believe that they can do so in a decent, moral, ethical way that aligns with any religious view, right? Because you just can't, right? So we have to stop destroying the earth. And I think synthetic biology, if used responsibly and carefully and in a way that's controlled by governance and guardrails, can help us to do that, you know, and therefore should be developed. But at the same time, we do need to think carefully about how we do it and about what the limits are that we're prepared to accept.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it could be such a wonderful solution to some of the destructive tendencies that we exhibit now. Now, you mentioned governance and guide rails. So who would be the, I guess, governing body or how would those guardrails come into being?
Yeah. You know, in the 12th chapter of my book, which is the chapter's called A Sketch, it's called A Manifesto for Life. But in the chapter, I say it's a sketch for a manifesto for life because no individual, you know, has the right or even the ability to kind of sketch out the future of life, right? I wouldn't presume to be able to do that. But I did try and create some kind of outline infrastructure, you know. Now, fortunately, most of the reviews of my book have been very positive. One review, however, kind of as their bit of criticism said, oh, but he didn't, you know, he didn't tell us exactly how we're going to do the governance part of it. And you know what? I mean, give me a break here, you know. I mean, I don't think any individual is going to come up with the kind of perfect way forward for governance. And we also know that getting a consensus on anything is near impossible. Like even within a country, you know, America is like diametrically split down the middle between pretty much two ideologies, right? Let alone the world, right? So, but hopefully even with the political and religious differences that divide the world and even individual countries, we will all be able to agree that it's in everybody's common interest that we don't destroy nature, right? And that we preserve nature and that we don't release organisms that are dangerous. And I hope that we will be able to reach a consensus on that. Who's going to organize that? Well, it's going to have to be at the governmental level, right? And you know, people like me are available to help do that. And I'm by no means the only person thinking about this. And, you know, get together a group of like-minded people and create a kind of entity whose role it is to come up with these guidelines and take the manifesto that I've drafted as a starting point or something similar and kind of begin to evolve that into a working document that everybody can kind of agree on and use as a kind of North Star, right? But this isn't going to be simple. It's not going to happen overnight. Fortunately, you know, we have enough time to do this because we're only at the very beginning of our capabilities. But hey, if we don't do it now, we're going to find ourselves stumbling into a world which has totally inadequate governance. I mean, actually, even today, that's happening. You know, people are doing things that, you know, the governance just isn't ready for, you know, it doesn't exist because the governance doesn't anticipate the future. It deals with things as they occur, right? But I think we're going to have to change philosophically the way that we view governance. Instead of playing catch up the whole time, we're going to have a government department that anticipates where things are going to be before they happen, right? So that inventions and science are kind of easing into a kind of infrastructure of governance before they happen, if you see what I mean, which is there before they happen, rather than the inventions and science happening and then the governance kind of trying to deal with it, right, which is not the best way of proceeding. But that's how we're doing it today, right? So I think a kind of the government department of futurology, if you like, may not be a bad thing, because, you know, we call it futurology, but actually there are some things which are kind of inevitable, I would say, right? You know, mm-hmm. we can kind of see the way things are going. And so why not have a government department that kind of addresses, you know, AI, biology, engineering, quantum computing, and says that these things, we know they're happening. We right. know where they're heading, right? We know what they're likely to produce. So let's just kind of try and model where we think they're going to be in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, and at least focus on the near term and try and imagine what we're going to have to create the governance for, so that the governance is kind of there, at least in a rudimentary sense, ready mm-hmm. to accept the inventions as and when they happen, right? It's a much better way of doing things than just being unprepared in the way that we are today.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It would be best to have as much of those guidelines and governance in place prior to invention in creation. But now, what do you think this next decade looks like with biology becoming a programmable engineering discipline?
Well, I think that, you know, within maybe 5 to 10 years, you know, our ability to actually predict biology in a very specific way and to build things according to plans, to designs, using this kind of grammar book is going to be hugely advanced from what it is today. I think this field's going to move very, very swiftly, very mm-hmm. swiftly. And I just think that this is going to be incredibly exciting, because it will mean that we can build a lot of things from biology, right? And we'll stop mm-hmm. using destructive chemical technologies, which, if you think about it, are just trying to mimic nature because we can't understand nature. Let's take steel, for example, right? Why do we use steel? Because steel, you know, steel is an incredible material, right? And but guess what? Spider silk has the same tensile strength as steel, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and if we used AI, we could probably make it into something that's 5 times or 10 times the tensile strength of steel. So do we need to make steel in the way that we've always done, or could we make a kind of biological steel, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, concrete, for example, cracks, right? But we know that we can make bioconcrete by putting in microorganisms that repair the cracks in concrete, for example, right? So I think that in the next kind of 10, 20 years, our mastery of the grammar of life is going to hugely increase, and we're going to be seeing biological devices and materials and, you know, modes of energy production and information storage creeping into our everyday life, until eventually pretty much everything will be built biologically and sustainably, you know. And it, and as I said, you know, biology has the advantage that you can also embed intelligence into materials, so you can develop intelligent materials which right now don't exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I see us as being at the cusp of this multi-trillion dollar bioeconomy, and anybody who, you know, gets into this space is really going to be position to do extremely well, which is why America has this tremendous opportunity to take the lead, and which is why it makes absolutely no sense to degrade America's ability to produce world-class science. You know, we mm-hmm. should be, instead of reducing investments in science, we should be ramping this up and ensuring that we do not lose out to countries like China and Korea or any other country, right? I mean, America should be the global hub of innovation, not just for AI and tech, but for biotech, right? And
yeah.
we have all the ingredients, we have all the talent, we have, you know, so we need to ramp up our investment in infrastructure to ensure that we remain in the pole position. Because I can tell you one thing, whoever owns, you know, the leadership position in bioengineering will own the future.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, we're talking about a multi-trillion dollar bioeconomy, and we just need to have the common sense to see that bioeconomy on the horizon and to be the first people to kind of just capitalize on it and make sure that we are running that economy, right?
Yeah.
And that we own it and that we're indispensable. And that just requires a little bit of foresight and investment into what one of the things that America does best in the world, which is to do good science.
Absolutely. So the last question is, what do you hope that readers will take away from reading On the Future of Species?
Well, I hope, you know, that they'll just actually understand the whole field, because I, you know, I've written this book deliberately to be understandable by everybody, right? I mean, there was no point in writing a kind of book that could be read by 10 people, right? So although, you know, and well, although the book is simple, it doesn't trivialize the topic, right? So I think that pretty much anybody would be able to read my book if they really want to and come out of it as a kind of expert in the field who really has a deep, deep understanding of this. You can't not understand this in the modern world, right? Everybody, every single person on earth needs to be conversant and familiar with this topic, right? Because it's so relevant to them and to their future. And they also need to be able to have an informed opinion on this topic so that they can participate in the debate. Because the issues at stake here are so fundamental. I mean, we're talking about things as fundamental as the continued nature of human nature. You know, because in theory, human nature itself could change, right? Because we could rewrite the human genome, right? So I just hope that people read my book and feel that they're entertained and fascinated by the wonders of nature, but also about this extraordinary new science of synthetic biology, or what we also call generative biology, and this new ability to unpick the grammar of life and to speak the grammar, you know, to create books, if you like, and narratives using the language of life, which not only change nature as it currently is, but reimagine it. And in a sense, biology becomes a kind of art form where you know, where you're writing new works of art, if you like, in the language of DNA, which can actually help humanity. And I see, you know, a time in the future where kids at school will be designing biological systems, you know, because kids are very creative, as we know, and they'll be able to use these rules on their computers at school, and they'll be doing stuff that's consequential.
Wow. Yeah, that would be amazing. That would be amazing. Well, Adrian, thank you for your time today. This has really been a wonderful conversation, and I really want to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Robert. It's been such a pleasure, and I've really enjoyed the conversation. Great questions, and thanks for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. And again, everyone, today my special guest has been Adrian Wolfson, author of On the Future of Species, Authoring Life by Means of Artificial Biological Intelligence, and it is due to be released on April 28th. And for more information, you can visit Adrian's website, which is adrianwolfson.com, and that's Adrian, WOOLFSON.com. And in closing, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.